Coming up next, it's the Magnuson Park Gallery Exchange, an opportunity to hear directly from artists and those in the arts community. Learn what really inspires and motivates the creative work shown in the Magnuson Park Gallery.
Hi everybody, this is Terrico Summers with Magnuson Park Gallery. As you know, Magnuson Park Gallery is committed to providing a space in which new and emerging artists can show their artwork in Seattle. We are happy to tell you that our current show has 50 different local artists. This show includes everything from glass sculptures, oil paintings, watercolors, photography, woven texture works, and even a laser-cut light-up diorama. This show is called Environmental Ties 2 because last year's was so successful. So we're doing it again, and each piece in this show represents the artist's ideas of the intersection of human-built and the natural environment. So if you're curious about art or the environment, this would be a great show for you to see, and it runs till April 19th. Last night, many of the artists came out for a fun, casual happy hour. This is a very eclectic group of work, tying in the relationship of humans and nature. So it was interesting when we went around the room and each artist spoke a little about the specific method of creating their piece. And to find out just a little about how each artist developed their technique and formed their work was really inspiring. I still have so many questions about some of these works, so I decided to see if some of the artists would come in and explain their unique methods. And luckily for us, a few of the artists agreed. So I'm happy to say that I'm starting off with Sharon Gatula, who is a beautiful encaustic piece, or has a beautiful encaustic piece in our show. Welcome to space, Sharon.
Thank you so much, Terrico. I'm so happy to be here.
Everybody loves your encaustic piece.
Oh, thank you.
I just kind of wanted to get a little bit about your background as an artist and how you've started developing your talent.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Well, I actually started off in photography. My father and grandfather were both amateur photographers. They loved photographers. They loved photography. My grandfather had a darkroom in his basement. And when I was a kid, I would like grab his twin lens reflex cameras and run around with them because it was just so fun to see how it flips the image and crops the world into like this little vignette. And I always was fascinated with that. And in college, I actually started off in marine biology, and halfway through, diverged into photography. I think there was a moment in botany where I was like, if I have to look through a microscope one more time, I'm just not going to make it through this course. And so photography just has always been my first love and really what I studied. And I spent 15 years in Los Angeles as a commercial and editorial photographer. And then when the kids came around and found myself kind of stuck at home with toddlers, I started diving back into the fine art world. And I had always wanted to get my photography out from behind the glass and frame, sort of like, you know, photography on the wall. And when I encountered encaustic for the first time about, oh goodness, 20 years ago, I'd never heard of it. Like, it's not well known, like oil or acrylic or anything. And so encaustic is taking beeswax and you combine it with Damar resin, not Damar varnish. It's Damar resin. So it's like tree sap. And this changes the melting point of the beeswax and changes like the flammability of it. So you can melt the wax down to about 180 degrees. I use like a pancake palette and it becomes liquid. And so then you can paint with it and then it hardens immediately, which I love because I have zero patience. Like I want things to be done right now. And what it enabled me to do was to combine photography with paint and other paper ephemera and create these collages that I'd never been able to do before. And I was just completely hooked. Mm-hmm. 20 years ago, like I just changed my whole trajectory of everything I was doing and just became an encaustic artist.
Okay. Tell us a little about your piece, because I know you mentioned something about like you used some Japanese, very thin Japanese paper on it.
So my pieces start, you know, like every artist loves a good process, right? Mm-hmm. Because there are days in the studio where you're like, I don't know what I'm going to do. But if you have a process, you have a starting point. And so my pieces usually start with a collage layer. And so I just like take up all my papers and I just rip them up and make this random collage. And then from that, I get inspired by the color palette. So whatever papers are down there inspires the color palette that goes on next. So then I paint colored wax all over it. And then I print on this Japanese paper. It's called Tengucho, and I'm probably butchering how to actually say it. I'm sure it's pronounced completely different in Japan. I buy it from Hiromi Paper in Los Angeles, and it's used a lot in archiving artwork. Archivists will use this really thin paper on the backside of oil paints when there's a rip to seal it down. And it's really fragile. You know, you can see through it. And what I love about it is that I have painstakingly developed a method of being able to print through my Epson printer onto this paper. And when you layer it into the wax, once it becomes embedded in the wax, all the white becomes transparent. And so you're left with that black infrared image of the trees on Winter Solstice, the piece in the show, so that you get this collage layer, then this paint layer, and then this black and white photography layer. And you can kind of see through all of it, but it's not transparent, which I love. It's kind of mysterious.
Okay. About the image of the trees, mm-hmm. the other night, I loved what you said about the nature point. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. So The series of work that Winter Solstice is from is called Beyond the Visible Spectrum. And it really started playing around initially with that infrared photography, because the infrared makes all the green leaves disappear. They all become white. And so it allows like the structure of the tree to be the main focal point. And I just love the idea of all the research we've been doing on trees over the last, I don't know, decade or so, that's coming out, where trees can talk to each other through the mycelium network. And we're so egocentric as humans, thinking that we are like the only sentient beings. And I think just in a way, we live on these different frequencies, like humans are on this one frequency and maybe trees are on a different, right? So they have this extended lifespan. You know, some trees are over 2,000 years old. And I think that it's interesting. We've got like the frequency of like the modern city. We've got the frequency of nature that's kind of more stoic. It's more everlasting. It's more regenerative, maybe. And then we've got like the human element, which is kind of chaotic, especially at the moment.
You explained that so well.
Thank you.
I just also wanted to find out a little bit about are you moving into some different areas in the future?
Well, I have a couple of different projects going on at all times. Mm-hmm. So I've got the Beyond the Visible Spectrum, which I've got, I don't know, maybe 10 or 12 pieces that are done. And I've got like 6 pieces in the studio that are in progress. Every time I go anywhere and I see a cool tree, I'm like, oh my God, I have to photograph it. This is going to be an amazing piece. And then I also do a lot of collage work that deals a lot with memory and loss. My father passed away 2 years ago.
Sorry.
And for the last 2 years of his life, I was bouncing between Seattle and Los Angeles constantly in this sort of like sandwich generation, right? Like I've got kids and I've got elderly parents, and just dealing with sort of that, you know, like when you're bouncing around a lot, like your memory starts to like confused, kind of like COVID, like no one, like everything's pre-COVID, post-COVID, right? And then I'm really passionate about helping artists with their marketing. So my day job, I co-own a video marketing company with my friend Laura Garfield. Shout out mm-hmm. to Laura. And we work in, you know, a very business space. And I want to take all of this business knowledge that we have amassed over the years of being in business and transfer it to artists, because I think all of these business practices work in the art community. You know, if you need to have like long-term goals, if you're going to make this into a business. And I think the art schools have come a long way. When I was in art school, there was no business training whatsoever.
Right, right. And I think it's really difficult as an artist going out and translating it into actually selling art.
Yeah, especially when, your blood.
Especially in Seattle.
Yeah, well, and your blood, sweat, and tears are in it. And so it's so personal, and it gets really hard to market that, because it's like it's such a punch to the gut when things are rejected. And once you can get into the idea that it's myart.llc versus me, it's so much easier to not disassociate, but separate yourself a little bit from that. So the rejections aren't you personally. The rejection is like, this wasn't right for this venue.
I see. Oh, no, that's really, really good. And how can people contact you in terms of you said you had a Substack maybe?
Yeah. So on my blog, and I have a Substack that every week I try to put up something businessy oriented, or maybe, you know, sometimes it's just fluff and fun. But you can find me at SharonGotula.com. That's two T's, one L. And it's pretty much Sharon Gotula Studios on every social media out there. So Substack, Instagram,
okay,
YouTube.
And one final question. What music inspires you when you're painting?
Oh, that's a good question. What's funny is I don't typically listen to music when I paint. I usually listen to a podcast.
Oh.
There's a lot of great business art podcasts out there that I love to listen to. I love Art Juice. They're really always fun and, you know, kind of lighthearted. But I would say when I'm listening to music, it's usually like some kind of world music. Like, I was into Latin trap for a while.
Okay.
It's so, like, chill and mellow.
Mark does world music.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, oh, that's great. Well, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us. It really helped understand your encaustic piece.
Thank you so much. It was great. And the show was amazing. You and Maddie did an amazing job taking a lot of disparate elements, a lot of different styles, and making it feel very cohesive.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, next up we have Neil Berkowitz, who's a visual artist in Seattle. Hey, Neil, welcome to Space.
Well, glad to be here.
I wanted to kind of get a little bit about your background first. You mentioned that you were originally from New York?
Metropolitan New York, Hudson Valley, one of the most underrated, beautiful places in America.
Oh, good. I love New York. What is your background in, I mean, how did you become an artist?
Well, I think I actually became an artist in the summer program after sixth grade, a science program, where they took, you know, bunches of us into a large closet for science to teach us chemical reaction by doing photographic exposures and printing on a contact printer. And it just, I was hooked.
Okay.
And so I went on to Syracuse University a number of years later and studied in the journalism school in photography. It was a wonderful program.
Okay.
Did some photography and then walked away and 10 years ago started up again and really returned to a practice that was lens-based at that time and is now expanding in other ways.
Okay. Can you, you have a beautiful piece in the Environmental Ties show. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. That's a piece that reflects several concerns that I have and reflected in the approach that I take. So the image you're talking about, for folks who can't see it, they can see it on neilberkowitz.com, my website.
Okay.
It's layered photographic images. In this case, all of the images layers were images that were regular photographs, but mostly I take a lot of layer photographs that would never stand up on their own. They need to be part of something else. But layering is important to me for a couple of reasons. It reflects how we experience things. We connect this experience and that experience. We go for a hike. We remember the most beautiful vistas. But the experience is important by the whole thing and what's in between. Mm-hmm. Another concern is with place identity and identity more broadly. You know, where does one place end and another begin, if that's the case? Mm-hmm. So this image from a series called Ode to Public Lands is a series that examines places in connection to each other. So it's got a Nisqually National Wildlife Refuge layer. It's got an Eby's Landing layer and provides some depth that folks really need to pay attention to look more carefully. And that probably is the most important driving force in my work. What do we pay attention to? What's in plain sight that we don't see, and why?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was looking very closely at all the, because it looks like some people are looking out at the landscape, and I was trying to figure out what different environments they were, because it looked like there was a wetland of some sort, and then there was a forest all in one piece of photography. I wasn't even sure if it was photography at the time because it was so beautiful, but I couldn't really tell like if there was some you know, digital imaging or something else in there. So
I do sometimes include other layers, digital custom text brushwork in some of my newer work, but and prints and photographs of prints on top of photographs, photographs of traditional prints on earlier photographs and so forth. But in this case, they were all photographic images.
Okay. And you mentioned also that the piece that you had in our show was a smaller version of a larger piece. And I can't even imagine that being, you know, larger than life.
Yeah, that has been exhibited twice in the past year, in a 44-inch high by 76-inch wide version.
Oh, wow.
Unframed and unmounted.
Okay.
And I like unframed and unmounted because for me, it reminds us that art is perishable, and that things of value should be appreciated while we have them. So I also think there's something about photography and traditional printmaking, which are more easily reproducible, that give them kind of a more democratic feel, that folks can access the originals, if it were, in ways that, you know, only one person really has the original of that painting. So that's why I do it unframed and unmounted, and large is always nice.
So is that what you're going into? You mentioned something about doing more public work?
So I've spent the past year and a half taking advantage of being old, because many of the universities here and colleges have programs for seniors.
Oh, great.
So the senior access program at the UW doesn't allow you to take studio art courses, but the digital arts classes you can. And I felt for a number of years that folks need to engage better with art, and one of the ways to do that is to add some movement, their movement through a space, and some temporal elements too. So I started out by working on video, and now I've developed skills to do large immersive installations, and am now an alternate for a exhibition-based residency at Jack Straw, where I would be doing an immersive sound-based project should someone else not be able to participate in the residencies.
Okay, yeah, you mentioned Jack Straw. And so what else are you kind of thinking about moving forward with besides the visual, the large installations?
Well, I think...
Or like what themes?
I think the themes have stayed fairly constant for me. Mm-hmm. It's a matter of how I take the medium and work with that theme. So the theme right now for me is self-censorship, how we block out what we should be paying attention to and aren't in our everyday lives. And why that is, I think, and the issue I think of when I do this is that we live in a world of made things. We may think of art as a made thing. We don't necessarily think of ideas as a made thing. And going back to the current exhibit on nature, for me, even nature is a made thing. It's made by thousands of years of interacting with nature. So there may be nature, but nature isn't necessarily natural. It's been impacted by us in all sorts of ways. So I think dealing with art as a made thing, and particularly photography, which since its inception, the makers of photography have set it aside and said, you know, art, it's an interpretation, but photography captures. And that's a myth. You stand a foot differently, you raise the camera, you use a different shutter speed and get different depth of field. All these things impact the product. And so I think folks need to know in an age of AI that we're not dealing with AI as a new special, now they're manipulating what we see. Every ad on television is a manipulation. Mm-hmm. Everything is. So the question isn't true or false. It's to what end. This stuff that I see, that I learn, that I read in the paper, that I read online, that I get unsolicited emails on, this is all stuff that has been made. And we have to ask, why is it part of my world now? What was the intention of the person making it?
Mm-hmm. You mentioned something earlier about, which I loved, is when I was asking you about your inspirations, and you mentioned that it was really not a certain artist, that it's always a one piece of work that really captures your inner imagination, heart. And can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, there are several questions that always make me bristle inside. And one of those is, who's your favorite artist? Because I think, for me, the value is in looking at the individual work first. And so I have favorite pieces of art. I have, from there, gone to folks who I would go out of my way to see their work, because it's the work, and my hope is to see some of that work. There are also artists who you can't really understand and appreciate unless you see a body of their work. But it's still the work that's important to me and the work that I like.
Mm-hmm. So, Neil, do you have a certain type of music or an artist that you like to listen to when you're working?
That's a great and very difficult question for me, because
probably should have prompted you earlier.
Because I think it's a matter of what kind of work I'm doing and how focused am I.
Me too.
And so I listen to everything from jazz, jazz of the 60s and 70s in particular. Mm-hmm. But I grew up on folk. I'm a big fan of the Folklife Festival, so I listen to folk and bluegrass and other things too, and a lot of world music. And I delight in Seattle's breadth of great music that's performed here. So
that's some really interesting information. I so appreciate you coming in and talking to us.
Well, this is wonderful. Glad to help.
Thank you. Thanks so much to all the artists who came in today and gave us a little knowledge of their methods and individual techniques into creating. If you want to see these pieces mentioned in real life, come down to see the Environmental Ties 2 show at Magnuson Park Gallery, located in Building 30. The open dates are Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays from 12 to 3. The show goes on till April 19th. And then we're having a closing party on April 19th, where you'll get a chance to meet all the different artists. It's from 1 to 4. The whole, community will come together and celebrate our beautiful environment. And that's all for today. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the Magnuson Park Gallery Exchange, a periodic series focused on the artists and the arts community showing at the Magnuson Park Gallery.